All right, we're going to talk about the topic of prenatal genetic testing. Big topic. But there's a few key ideas that I want to talk about. We're going to approach this in two ways. What is prenatal genetic testing, and what does it mean? So we're going to talk about screening versus diagnostic testing and the difference between the two. We're going to talk about false positives and false negatives. And we'll talk about what tests are currently available and what exactly they tell us. We'll also talk about issues of why should you test or why shouldn't you test? And also whether or not we're looking for a diagnosis or a neighbor. So let's first talk about screening versus diagnostic tests. Screening tests are tests given to the general population. And the idea is to find out, to try to find the group of people who are at higher risk. Okay? Who is more likely to have the problem? So it takes the general population and narrows it down and says, okay, this group is more likely to have the problem and the rest of them are unlikely to have the problem. Diagnostic tests are given to the people we identify who are at higher risk to say, do you or do you not actually have the problem? This is probably the most important thing I'm going to tell you today, and that's the difference, the issues of false positives and false negatives. So bear with me a little bit. There are, in reality, four possibilities when you take a test, okay? Let's look at the top first. Either the baby really does have a problem, or the baby in reality does not have a problem. This is what is really actually true. But what we have in the test is the test says that the baby has a problem, or the test says that the baby does not have a problem. This is what the test says. So you can see there are actually four possibilities. We have a true positive. The test says that the baby has a problem, and yes, indeed, the baby really does have a problem. Or the test says that the baby does not have a problem, and the baby really does have a problem. That's called a false negative. Or the test can say that the baby has a problem and the baby really doesn't. That's called a false positive. Or the test says that the baby does not have a problem and the baby really doesn't have a problem. So the four possibilities, the four categories, that's what you have to understand with any test, even the diagnostic tests. But it's important to understand how this works out in what you do with the answers to a test. And there's sorry for the technicality, but it's actually important that you understand what these terms mean when you look at screening tests. The true positive is the positive predictive value. That is how when the test says that the baby has a problem, how many of those positive tests, how often will the baby actually have the problem? That's a positive predictive value. False positive looks at specificity. False negative is the term used as sensitivity. And true negative, that is when the test says that the baby does not have a problem and the baby doesn't have a problem, that's the negative predictive value. Why do I bring this up? Because when these tests are advertised, they are advertised as 99% sensitive. And the average person thinks that means that 99% of the time when this test is positive, it's true. But that's not what it means at all. And it's very deceptive. So if you look at the websites that advertise these tests, what they actually report is the sensitivity, but not the positive predictive value. And I'm going to use an example to show you why this is important. This is from the American College of OB-GYN. It looks at what, in reality, the most sensitive screening test called the cell-free DNA test, what in reality does it tell us about trisomy 21, which is Down syndrome? And I'm going to put it on our little graph so it makes it easier. Okay, if you take 10,000 women in the general population, we know the general population has a 1 out of 1,000 risk for Downs. Okay? So in 10,000 women, there are 10 Down syndrome babies. And there are 9,990 babies that do not have Down syndrome. But the test will say that 30 babies have Down syndrome and 9,970 don't. Well, let's look at those positive tests. How do they break down? There are only 10 that really have Down syndrome. So that means there's 20 that are falsely reporting that the baby has Down syndrome and it doesn't. That means for the most sensitive test, the positive predictive value, how often a positive test is correct is only 30%. Well, 33%. How often is it correct that when the test is negative, the baby doesn't have a problem? Most of the time, 100%. Now, that's only because we took a population of 10,000. When you generalize that to 100,000 or a million, then you are going to get some false negatives. But the most concerning thing are these false positives. Here you've got people who've been told this test is 99% sensitive and the test is positive for your baby with Down syndrome. Why do they do anything else? They're just going to go out and they're going to do what they're going to do, which is, unfortunately, many times people are aborting on the basis of a screening test and not a diagnostic test. This is Solomon Diamond, who was born healthy after his parents were told that he had a fatal genetic disorder. This is a false positive. This is a baby. So let's look at the screening test in a high-risk population. Say that in your population there's a 1 out of 100 prevalence. That means 1 out of 100 babies in your population has Down syndrome. Okay, but you don't know which ones. Okay, so in 10,000 women, that means 100 Down syndrome babies will be there somewhere. And 9,900 will not. But the test is going to report positive in 119. And negative in 9,881. So let's look at that. The distribution of true positives and false positives is there are more true positives in a high-risk population. Okay, so the more actual Down syndrome babies there are in a population, the more often the test, which says it's positive, will actually be positive. That is, the positive predictive value increases. But the more you have a population that has a high prevalence, a large number of Down syndrome, the more likely that a negative test it could be wrong. Okay? So you have the problem in a population that has a lot of babies with a problem of not only false positives but false negatives. And this is Belinda Boydston with her son Hunter before he died of trisomy 18. Boydston's prenatal screening test missed the diagnosis. The tests are not perfect. And if there's nothing else that you want to take home from this test, from this lecture, this is important to understand. These tests are not perfect. So I put this up because it compares the general population to the high-risk population, and you see down the boxes second from the bottom that the positive predictive value is very small in the general population but higher in the high-risk population. Okay, well, what tests are currently available? And what do they tell us? The screening tests currently available are, one of them looks for chemicals in the mother's blood. That's called the triple or the quad screen. There's also something new called looking for fetal DNA in the mother's blood. That's cell-free fetal DNA. And it's a screening test that looks at the baby by ultrasound to look structurally to see if the head and the heart and the spine are all normal. Those are all screening tests. Those are all given to a general population. When a screening test is positive, then you go to diagnostic tests, and those are where you actually get some tissue. Okay, you can analyze tissue from the placenta. That's called chorionic villus sampling. You can analyze cells from the fluid around the baby. That's called amniocentesis. And also we talked about in the last lecture, you can do what's called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. So if you have an embryo outside of the mother's womb, you can take a piece of the embryo and look at the cells from there. What do we do with this tissue? Well, there's several ways to analyze the tissue. One is to do something called a karyotype. That's to take the cells, look at the DNA, and see how many chromosomes are there. You can do something called FISH, fluorescent insight to hybridization. And you can do something called chromosomal microarray. We're going to talk a little bit about this. The karyotype literally just grinds and finds. It just roughly takes these cells, lines up all the chromosomes, and then this is an example of trisomy 18. The 18th chromosome, there's three of them. fish is where the DNA is probed with a little detector for abnormalities. So here's the detector and here's the DNA. And if it detects an abnormality, it sticks and then it lights up. Okay, and that's why it's fluorescent. So you look for areas of lighting up that are a problem, and that's the positive sign that a person has a problem. Chromosomal microarray, we're going to talk a little bit more about, because this is actually going to replace pretty much everything. What they do is they take, in the red above, DNA, normal DNA, whatever normal DNA is, and they test it against DNA from a patient. It's green, the green part. And they put them together, and they see where they don't fit. And those areas where they don't fit show up either as areas where the chromosomes have been lost, deletion, or area where extra chromosomes have been gained. It's very accurate. But it's only as accurate as the tissue that you get. Okay, so for example, in chorionic villus sampling, there are times when the placenta is abnormal and the baby is just fine. So what you test is not necessarily reflective of what the baby actually is. And there are times in the embryo when they do pre-implantation genetic diagnosis where a piece of the embryo is abnormal and the embryo later heals itself and becomes completely normal. So a test is only as good as what you're looking at, and you have to remember no test is perfect. What does chromosomal microarray detect? It looks for extra or missing chromosome segments, microdeletions, microduplications, and abnormalities of chromosome number. Okay, so that is testing. That's what's available and the concept behind the false positives and false negatives and where they come from. But we're going to look at a little bit something else now. We're going to shift gears and say, why should we do testing, or why shouldn't we do testing? Well, diagnostic tests are generally used in medicine to benefit the person that's affected by the disease that the test reveals, while avoiding harm out of proportion to the benefit that the testing can provide. So, for example, if I wanted to find out if you were chromosomally normal and I cut your arm off, that would be a very poor diagnostic test. It would give the answer, but you have no arm after that, okay? So you want a test that doesn't hurt anybody but actually gives an accurate answer. But the interesting thing is that when you look at the ethics behind this, you got to have a very clear sense of what are the goals of testing. Why are we doing this? So in the context of pregnancy, testing may benefit the mom, may benefit the fetus, or may benefit both. But the goals of the testing differ depending on who's the beneficiary. This is a very good article that goes through the ethics of testing, but I think it's actually just a hair naive, because they talk about benefits to the unborn child, and there's actually very, very few diagnoses that you can make that will benefit the unborn child. There's a few, and especially with ultrasound, you can planned delivery, you see that there's a gastroschisis or something else. You can actually benefit by guiding the delivery, but there aren't many diagnoses where the fetus directly benefits from being diagnosed. The parents can benefit in a couple different ways, which we'll talk about, but who else benefits? Third-party payers. And believe me, there's a lot of money in prenatal testing, because it's much, much easier to pay for an abortion than it is to pay for treatment for an abnormal child. And society, when we want to get rid of people who really aren't perfect. Those are all the people who have an interest in this prenatal testing. Well, why shouldn't you test? Okay. If the abnormal test truly would not change anything that you do with your pregnancy, it wouldn't matter whether Aunt Jane was present, it wouldn't matter anything, then there isn't a really strong reason to test. The test results showing an abnormality color the whole rest of the pregnancy. So once you get the diagnosis and mom's been told your baby has a fetal anomaly, the joy, the delight, the anticipation, it's gone. It's gone. Because they're dreading the birth. They're dreading the loss, even if they love the child. And my daughter encouraged me to self-disclose to you at this point. I have walked this road. Okay, I've had a child that was not had a fatal abnormality, was not diagnosed, died after birth. The second child we tested, test was positive, fatal abnormality. So I know what it's like to feel the joy drained from the pregnancy. So you just don't, you don't even appropriately bond because you know hello's going to be goodbye. And it turned out that the test was wrong. He didn't have it when he was born. So, you know, I have a, this is not an objective talk for me. This is a pretty close to the heart talk. I just wanted to let you know that. So the test results themselves can disrupt the bonding process. And the test results form a first impression of that child. So if your first impression of the child is he's a defect, that really, it's a pretty deep psychological problem that interferes at the very beginning of the bonding process. Children are more than their diagnoses. Well, then why should we test? Well, you can't help the unborn child sometimes. It does make a difference if you know that the child has huge hydrocephaly. You're not going to try for a vaginal birth. You're going to have a C-section so that the baby has the best chances of coming out without any kind of damage. Some problems can actually be treated in utero that you see by ultrasound. You can close gastroschisis. There are things that can actually benefit the fetus. You also can help parents prepare for the birth of the child by getting accurate, up-to-date information to the parents and by connecting the parents with other parents in support groups. One of the brochures that's out at the Apalog table is this one. It's called Perinatal Hospice. It was actually developed by the president of Apalog in the past. And he was a perinatologist, a doctor that does high-risk pregnancies. So what he had a patient once who he told, you have a baby that's not going to live. And she said, well, can't you just help me support this baby until the baby's naturally born and then I'll say goodbye? And that was a revolutionary thought at the time. I realize that's not a revolutionary thought now. But at the time, this had never been done. So he did. He walked with her through the pregnancy. He got pastoral care involved. He got the nurses involved. They all knew when this baby's born, it's going to die. But lo and behold, what he found out is that when he treated patients that way, and of course, being a scientist, he studied the outcomes of all the patients he treated that way, he found that those patients, those families, had less difficulty grieving and bringing to resolution the loss of this child than the ones who were told, you have a fatal abnormality, and by the way, your abortion's scheduled for next week, next patient. So it's a way of treating the parents as parents and acknowledging the humanity of this child and preparing them the way you would prepare any other hospice patient for the death of a family member. So it's a much better approach, and it went from being pretty much scoffed at to, I think there's 600 perinatal hospice programs around the country, and it's something that we've found that even pro-choice OB-GYNs can embrace because this is truly a humane choice. This is a wanted pregnancy. This is parents who are engaged, and they do better if you actually let them be parents. So I'd encourage you to pick this up and give it to your OB-GYN if they don't know about this already. Well, why else test? To allow the parents to choose early to abort. And that's why the screening tests have been pushed back earlier and earlier. You can screen now at about 8-9 weeks with the cell-free DNA blood test. To help society identify and weed out the genetically imperfect. There is an interest group here that's very interested in weeding out genetically imperfect people. And to save healthcare dollars by identifying fetal care situations. And what do I mean by that? I'm going to read this to you because you can't read it real well. A pregnant woman whose living child was affected with cystic fibrosis sought prenatal testing for the disease. When testing revealed that the expected child would also be affected with cystic fibrosis, the woman and her husband faced an agonizing decision. They ultimately decided not to abort the fetus. But their HMO, which had originally approved the test, decided that it would not provide medical coverage for an affected child because the child had a pre-existing condition. The insurance company's message was clear. Parents could either abort the defective child or struggle alone with the huge financial burden of that child. Now, this was actually not in a pro-life journal. This was in you know, a newspaper article that was just appalled that an insurance company would deny care because a prenatal test was positive. The insurance company ultimately lost this. It was taken to court and they lost. But it's, I want you to know the thought is out there. Okay, this is looking at Down syndrome from 1974 to 2004. So the it's a little bit dated. The blue line is the expected number of babies that should be born with Down syndrome based on what we know is the rate of Down syndrome in the population. The red line is the number of babies actually born with Down syndrome. So we are missing about 3,000 Down syndrome babies because of prenatal genetic testing. They're aborted. So some choose to abort, some choose not to abort. I want you to pay attention to the words at the bottom, because these, what you're going to see, the children are speaking in different languages, so you'll get what's there by the words.
Don't be afraid.
Tu niño podrá hacer muchas cosas.
Podrá marcharte.
Podrá correr hacia ti.
Il pourra parler et te dire qu'il t'aime.
Il pourra aller à l'école
comme todos.
Il
pourra t'écrire. Si un jour elle est loin.
Because indeed, he'd be able to travel too.
Il pourra aider son père
à réparer son vélo.
Podrá laborar
y ganar su dinero.
Avec son salaire, il pourra t'inviter à dîner.
O affittare un appartamento e andare a vivere da solo.
A volte sarà difficile.
Io che tesco.
Quasi possibile.
E c'è pas pareil pour toutes les mères.
Dear future mom.
Tuo figlio potrà essere felice.
Come lo sono io.
E tu seras heureuse aussi.
Vero, mamma.
Interesting study that was done looking at parents who chose not to abort their childs when they were given a adverse prenatal diagnosis. And I just want to read some of the results because it's very helpful, and especially actually for pastors, it would be very helpful. Patients reported being told that their child was incompatible with life. 87% were told that. Would live a life of suffering, would be a vegetable, or would ruin their family. They were also told by some providers that their child might have a short, meaningful life, though. There was an editorial in the study which said, providers also often referred to their baby in dehumanizing terms, calling their baby an it, or a T18, meaning a trisomy 18. They recount interactions with providers who never learned their baby's name and instead referred to the child only by the diagnosis. 30% of parents requested full intervention as a plan of treatment. That is, when you go into the hospital and they say, do you want him to be a no-code? Do you want us to code him? What kind of, you know, how aggressive should we be? So a third requested full treatment. 79 of these children with the full trisomy 13 to 18 diagnosis are still living. The median age is 4 years, and they were told that this baby is incompatible with life. One of the important findings was that they asked parents if they regretted their choice regarding the extent of medical intervention. The parents who regretted their choices were overwhelmingly those who chose to limit medical interventions to comfort care only, or less than full intervention. So the ones who said, we want everything done, are the ones who had no regrets, whether the child was living or dead. Half reported that taking care of a disabled child is or was harder than they expected. Despite their severe disabilities, 97% of parents described their child as a happy child. Parents reported these children enriched their family and their couple, irrespective of the length of their lives. And the conclusions was parents who engage with parental support groups may discover an alternative positive description about children with trisomy 13 to 18. Disagreements about interventions may be the result of different interpretations between families and their healthcare providers about the experiences of disabled children and their quality of life. This is actually a very strong argument for prenatal genetic testing, because when you have a diagnosis that's an adverse diagnosis, you're told the baby has some severe genetic anomaly, it allows you time. Yes, you're going to grieve it, and yes, sometimes it's going to be wrong, but it actually allows the parents time to connect with other parents who have a child with a similar problem. And there are a number of different support groups online. All you have to do is Google trisomy 18. There's a trisomy 18 support group, SOFT, families of people who have genetic abnormalities. There's Down syndrome support groups. And being connected with the family ahead of time encourages families to be stronger against a very negative healthcare system. You know, it's terrible that these patients were told that their children are vegetables. I mean, that's just, it's unconscionable in this day and age that that's how healthcare providers were acting, but it is. So we've talked a little bit about why test, and I'm going to talk a little bit now about whether or not this child is a diagnosis, a T18, or is one of our neighbors that we care for his bodily needs. I'm going to introduce you to some people. This is Zane, written by his mom. He has trisomy 18, he will die, the neonatologist told us outside the NICU. The doctor flipped through the paperwork he had carried in, pictures of magnified chromosomes on Zane's fish. There are 3 of the 18 chromosomes instead of 2. Other papers made their way toward us. A doctor walked us through them. There was no sliver of hope, no loopholes allowing for Zane's well-being. With Zane's trisomy 18 diagnosis, his corner of the NICU shut down. There was no more bustle around his crib. The heart monitor had been pulled. The oxygen set was silenced. There was no longer immediacy to caring for Zane by anyone other than us, because he was going to die. They waited for him to die while we clung to all the living moments we had with him. Aside from the severe to profound mental retardation that the neonatologist warned us about, there are potential 130 anomalies associated with the condition that Zane had. Most prominent in all the literature is that trisomy 18 is fatal. Less than 10% make it to their first birthday. Jeff and I ran into the neonatologist in the NICU lobby, and he took extra time with us because our situation was hopeless. He asked us how we were doing and then incidentally told us that a number of Zane's tests had come back and there was no evidence of heart or renal problems. It looks like you'll be taking him home. He may live for a month or two. Despite many brushes with death, Zane continues to live. He's passed his 5th birthday, and I still wonder if this will be his last. Zane is very cognitively impaired and very physically impaired. He can't stand or walk, and he can't sit without support. But the great thing about him is he's such a happy kid. Here's Natalia, trisomy 13. And again, kind of tough to look at her face when she's born. It's kind of tough. But, you know, there is surgery, and you can live with these conditions that were once thought to be, quote, incompatible with life. There is no such thing as a living human being incompatible with life. It's an oxymoron. If you're alive, you're alive, and you're a living human being. This is also a little tough to look at. This is a boy named Jackson Buell. He's got microcephaly, and he's growing, and he's got a whole website with a foundation, the Jackson Strong Foundation. And if you look on there, and I was going to show you more videos, but there's a ton of videos I could show you. Jackson's growing. Starting to speak a little bit. He's not incompatible with life. Here's the other video that I want to show you.
Dear Elliot, right now you are 2 months from being born. We just found out that you have trisomy 18, also called Edwards syndrome. Doctors tell us that you won't likely make it to birth. Your mom and I are praying against that, we're praying for healing. We are praying for nothing less than a miracle. You're our first child, and the day of your birth couldn't come sooner. Dear Elliot, you were born today weighing in at 6 pounds. You are already a miracle to us. Your mom is doing well, and it looks like we'll be hanging out here at the hospital a little longer. Dear Elliot, today you turned 11 days old. We are so proud of you. Today we celebrated your 11th birthday. In fact, we do that every day at 4:59, the time you were born. Dear Elliot, we've been home for a week now, so that's why you don't see your nurses anymore. It's great to have you home. Today I think we'll pack up everything and take our first venture out for coffee. Dear Elliot, I don't know if you've noticed, but you're connected to some tubes. The doctors say we have to keep these in so you can get oxygen to breathe. You are also fed through a feeding tube. We feed you every 3 hours, and it takes an hour and a half to do it. We've loved learning how to best take care of you. We love it. Lots of people email, call, and send cards on your behalf. You're well loved. It's 11 at night right now, and my feeding shift has just begun. Mom is asleep, and the best part of my day has begun. My shift ends around 4:45 a.m. when your mom takes over. She cherishes her mornings with her boy. Today you turn 1 month old. I didn't know if I'd ever get to say that. To top off the day, 20 friends showed up at the door for a true surprise birthday party for you. They sang, brought balloons, and a birthday cake. It was beautiful chaos. At 2 a.m. this morning, your feeding tube came out. We had been warned this may happen eventually. We quickly realized we did not have a stethoscope, which was necessary to replace the tube. Since our neighbor was a nurse, I went ahead and knocked on their door at 2:30 a.m. They found their stethoscope, and your mom went to it. After much wrestling, praying, and your tears, the tube was down, and you were able to feed. Just so you know, your mom is my hero. Dear Elliot, you now weigh 7 pounds 3 ounces. You're growing, and your food has been bumped up because of your good appetite. You continue to find new ways to steal our hearts. Dear Elliot, today marks 2 months of your life. Your mom and I are so thankful we know you. We know your face, your noises. We know that bath time and massage are your favorite daily activity. You finally learned how to suck your thumb by yourself. Because of trisomy 18, you were born with clenched fists, and being able to do this is actually quite difficult. Way to go, son. Dear Elliot, we celebrate your birthday every day with a picture. Lately, we've tried to get a bit more creative. Dear Elliot, I realize you can get frustrated with your tubes and your frequent congestion. Please know that your mom and I are doing everything we can to make you comfortable. Dear Elliot, well, you tipped the scales today at 8 pounds, 14 ounces. Quite an accomplishment. You also have managed to grow a pretty decent mullet. Dear Elliot, we all got to go to a reunion at the hospital. I've never seen your mom more happy. The joy she felt getting to show off her son can't be described with words. In fact, she compared it to the way a mother would feel when her son becomes president or wins a Heisman or develops a cure for cancer. The logic of medicine says you shouldn't be alive, but you are. You are such a fighter. Dear Elliot, you have now passed the 3-month mark. You also got your first cordless pictures taken today. No feeding tube, oxygen, or stickers. This was no small accomplishment, but we got it done. Have I told you lately that we are so proud of you? Dear Elliot, today you went to be with Jesus. An underdeveloped lung, a heart with a hole in it, and DNA that placed faulty information into each and every cell of your body could not stop God from revealing himself through a child who never uttered a word. Not a pulpit, not a slick presentation, not a best-selling book, but a 6-pound boy with trisomy 18. God found great pleasure to take a lowly thing in the eyes of the world and show truth. At your funeral, we released 99 balloons. Each balloon representing a day of your life. How beautiful it was to watch. how quickly they were gone. And so today, we celebrate. Elliot, you are well. And although we miss you more than we can express, we're only separated from you by our time left on Earth. See you soon, son. Mom and Dad.
I had a member of our church as a nurse who knew the diagnosis was Down syndrome. And I think it was 6 years ago, roughly, Michael went to his heavenly home. Michael loved Christmas. Had a Christmas in July. All the hymns in the service were Christmas. He averaged about 18 times in the hospital the last 3 years of his life, but he lived to be 43.
Yeah.
And his mother, who's been a preschool helper the last 6 years until she retired this past year, always pointed out how people who have Down syndrome are living longer. Can you give us any statistics about how people are living longer if they have Down syndrome now?
I can't, other than what I can say is that it used to be, and again, this sort of old attitude by the medical profession, why bother to help? Why bother to treat? Because they've just got Down syndrome and they're going to die anyway. So the attitude has been changing, especially because of a group called the Jerome Lejeune Foundation. Jerome Lejeune is the doctor who discovered Down syndrome, was trisomy 21. And he, when he made the discovery, realized that this discovery could either lead to a search and destroy or could lead to more and longer life for these patients. So he set up an advocacy foundation called the Jerome Lejeune Foundation, and they advocate for care for Down syndrome, for education. They're the ones who put on that video, and they have a whole bunch of videos. I could have taken hours to show you the really touching videos that they have. But part of the reason that many Down syndrome are living longer is that people are more aware that this is a person who's just different, and we do need to take care of them. We need to treat their infections. We need to treat them like any other human being.
Well, the good news is Michael changed the congregation's life to be more helpful to people who are special needs, as my wife was worked in the special needs area for 17 years before she recently retired. And Michael changed the hospitals area that where he looked them at them as he called them hotels they would go to his last 3 years. And he liked going there because of the special treatment he got, mm-hmm. Because he was a happy kid. But also, I think really the big change is Michael and kids like Michael have changed our society's view is that they're not only is life there, but that they make a very positive contribution to life. I have a special needs niece who's 29 years old, and she always says, I love you every 5 minutes, and then about once every 30 minutes, and I love Jesus too, whether she's in your house or anybody else's house. So yeah. They do change people's lives for the better.
Yep, amen, brother.
One of the reasons that I have heard lately that why more kids are being born with birth defects or later come up with having some kind of defect is because like the mothers are being older they're older when they start to be pregnant and have kids. Is there a lot of factual evidence to back that up, or is that kind of just something that's being said because of just how society's changing?
No, it's actually true. The older you are, the more difficulty your eggs have in fertilizing. And initially, when amniocentesis was recommended for women over 35, it was because it was at the point of age 35 where the death from amniocentesis crossed the line, which was the likelihood of detecting a problem. So no, it's true. The older you get, the more genetic difficulties that your eggs have in fertilizing. The other thing is, the older you get, the more likely you are to have IVF, and IVF kids have more genetic problems. They just do. It's not hugely more, but it is more. And so I think actually kind of the take-home message with that, if I can segue a little bit, because I've seen this so often in my office, the professional woman that comes in at 35, 37, and says, and I say to her, well, what are your thoughts on a family? And she'd say, well, you know, I'm going to finish this, and I got 2 more years, and I'm going to get a house. And I'm thinking like maybe, you know, in 5 years or so. And I have to tell her, honey, you got a biological window of opportunity to have kids. And your chances of getting pregnant at 35 are about 85%. Your chances of getting pregnant at 40 are about 3. So, you know, it closes. And I think it's a reality that our society doesn't want to realize, but there is a window, and the window of opportunity is you have kids when you're in your 20s and 30s, because the later you go, the the more problems you encounter, to the point where you're not going to be able to spontaneously have kids often after age 40.
Okay. You mentioned, different levels of care on admission for someone who has a genetic difficulty. I would think that would be a terrible, almost a crucifying thing for the caregiving crew to be told, for instance, so-called comfort care, which is really euthanasia, in my opinion. Well, are there any recourses for these things?
Well, I'm actually glad you brought that up, because I only showed you a portion of Zane's of the article on Zane. There was a paragraph I cut out for time's sake, and that was they had a DNR order on Zane, and the staff disobeyed it, and they resuscitated him several times, and Zane lived, okay, because they couldn't sit there and watch Zane die. And so, is there any legal recourse? I don't know. It will take a little bit of time to answer that, but I'll tell you who could tell you is the Jerome Lejeune Foundation, because they are an advocate for all disabilities, not just Down's, but for all disabilities.
Do you know or have any evidence of pressure put on doctors and hospitals by insurance companies to do prenatal testing? Is that something that we need to keep our eyes open for? Or?
Not directly, but I will tell you that euthanasia is done. And let me give you an example. My sister's a lawyer. She's a guardian ad litem for kids in the hospital when they don't have anybody else care for them. So she had a baby diagnosed who was a child of a drug addict who couldn't care for this baby. This baby had a obstruction of its bladder so that the bladder couldn't release urine, and so it affects the kidneys. And so she said, I want the bladder surgery done. It's very simple. It's a simple surgery. And they said, it's a child of a drug addict. I don't know. We'll think about it. And she's like, no, I want this done. I am the legal guardian. I am signing for it. And I, as a family, am requesting this. Yeah, well, we'll have a committee discussion about it. Days go by. She says, okay, I'm going to transfer out. More days go by while she's rearranging the transfer. And right before the transfer, the child dies. Okay. So here was an act of euthanasia. I mean, the intent was to withdraw food and fluids from this child of a drug addict who had a problem and not waste society's resources on somebody who had, no reason, even though that child had a correctable abnormality. So, yeah. I mean, I called my perinatologist friends who are in APLOG, and I said, what can be done about this? They said, honey, this happens in hospitals all across the country all the time. Slow codes or, do not. Now, I'm not saying every hospital, but I'm saying that it's there, and there's judgments made, and depending on the worldview of the physician, they may or may not aggressively treat someone that they don't think has a good quality of life.
So I understand the pressure not to care. I was wondering specifically about pressure for prenatal testing.
For prenatal testing. I can't give you documentation of that. I can't.
I saw a presentation on a family with a trisomy 18 baby, and they said even though they were, completely committed to the baby's life and did everything they could to get care, they were afflicted with the slow code problem over and over again. And the baby had a breathing problem, and they had to just go through huge hurdles to get, some small surgery to, just for the baby to survive. I mean, they just put obstacles everywhere. I mean, I don't understand how this can be legal, how they couldn't sue or get some legal thing involved. I don't get it.
Well,
they're killing their child.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree that it's hard for me to fathom a doc not being aggressive with any human being. I mean, you should care to the extent that you can. But it's the difference in our society between a doctor caring for his patient, the Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm, and the doctor saying part of my responsibility is to allocate resources for society. And unfortunately, the prevailing zeitgeist in the medical community is doctors are the gatekeepers of medical resources, so that they need to be cognizant of, you know, where they're spending those resources. You know, to me, that's a little, it's awful. It is actually an attack at the heart of the Hippocratic Oath, attack at the heart of the doctor-patient relationship. And yes, in reviewing this topic, I found several stories where a do not resuscitate order was placed on the child's chart without the parent's knowledge,
yeah,
and the kids died. And so you just honestly have to stay on top of it.
But you can't get a malpractice suit against these people?
Well, in order to get a malpractice suit, I mean, I'm just telling you, you have to show that there's harm. You have to show that there's a breach of standard of care, and that you have to show that the breach showed harm. So in the case of a baby who's disabled, what harm are you going to show? They're going to die anyway. You can't show that they've lost 25 years of a good, productive life, which is all that society cares about. All you can show is they died sooner. So you will not win a malpractice suit.
Okay. Thanks. So in the case of people with disabilities who weren't initially expected to live very long and end up living to around 15 and beyond, they start to experience feelings of sexuality and maybe they even want to have marriage and things like that. But maybe they aren't necessarily capable of caring for kids or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So how do you deal with a situation like that?
Well, a lot of times with these very severely retarded babies, the part of their brain that stimulates puberty isn't going to. So I wouldn't say most of the time, but probably over half the time, they're not going to go through puberty because they don't have the pituitary stimulation.
Is Down syndrome included under that?
No.
Okay.
Down syndrome is not. But something like trisomy 18, trisomy 13, you know, you're talking about that.
Okay.
For Down syndrome, I mean, that's the call of the parents and the pastors and, you know, whatever counseling. Just like I wouldn't say to you, I don't think you should reproduce because mm-hmm. I don't like your genes. Who am I to say to you that you shouldn't reproduce? Mm-hmm. And it is a hard call. I mean, I have counseled patients who have had children who have clear genetic autosomal dominant, so it will be transferred. And some of them make the decision to sterilize. And some of them don't. I mean, it's the parents, if the child is not capable of consenting, it's the parents' call. And so it's the parents' call.
Okay.
I have a happy ending story.
Good.
My husband and I, before I was 25, we had three children in our family. And at the age of 38, I had gone to work to help get these three children through college, and I turned up pregnant. So I quit work, had this baby, who is now a Lutheran Church Missouri Synod pastor. 4 years later, I was pregnant again. And so this time when I went to my OBYGN, who had delivered the other baby, I had to sign papers because we found out we were in line for not only a Down syndrome child because of age, but also I had a spina bifida aunt. So we were in line for that. So we had to sign these papers at this point. And I think our physicians are getting so lawsuit scared, you know. They offered us amniocentesis. Mm-hmm. We chose not to do it, number one, because we would not have aborted the baby. But number two, I think there was either a 2 or 3 or 5% that we would lose the pregnancy. I would miscarry if they did that.
Mm.
So we chose not to do that. It did put a damper on the rest of the pregnancy. But I had this daughter 5 days before my 43rd birthday. She's beautiful. She's a cello. She grew up with the cello. She is an orchestra teacher. And God was so good. We had to put it in God's hands. And we said, you know, we're just going to open this package at the end of 9 months, like we did with our other children. And but I do know I was scared because the first thing out of my mouth as I was having this child, I said to the doctor, is she Down syndrome or is it Down syndrome?
Yeah.
So it just weighed heavily. But, you know, we just had to give it to God because there wasn't anything else that we wanted to do.
Yep. Thank you for sharing that.
With going off of what we were talking about with doctors making that decision, making decisions for you that you necessarily want for your infant, how is there like papers that you sign unknowingly, like in a hurry, like when your child's born, to get them NICU care that you should be making positive that you're reading? Like, I know you should always read every document that you sign, but in a frantic state, they're like, you need to sign this so we can give your child care. Mm-hmm. What is there anything that you should be positive that you're not doing just in case it would come to where your child is in the NICU and you want them to have 99 days of life and do everything they can?
Hospitals should not slip in a DNR paper in the midst of all the insurance stuff. They shouldn't do that. And I mean, I can't speak for every hospital across the country, mm-hmm. but quality hospitals, generally when there's a DNR discussion, it's usually a discussion with chaplaincy present and physicians present. It's usually not like an on-the-fly. Now, if you have a DNR order in your patient's chart and it's there, you may not know about it, especially if you didn't place it. And doctors are not obligated to do what they call futile care. So you may want everything done, but a doctor is not obligated to do that if they think in their medical judgment that it's futile. So that's we have right of conscientious objection that way, even though we don't have a guaranteed right of conscientious objection not to abort. But so you should be careful with everything that you sign, and it's very difficult, having now taken care of my mother, who's in her 90s, on the other end of the spectrum, it's very difficult because when you enter the hospital system, you leave behind all the people that know her. Mm-hmm. It's the hospitalist, and it's the intern, and I'm sorry, I've had to tell a couple of interns, look, buddy, read her chart, okay? Read her chart. Don't talk to me until you read her chart, because they come in and, you know, but without being able to be aggressive without being able to manage her care, it would be a truly frightening experience because the right hand doesn't talk to the left.
Yeah.
And just to give you a picture, some of the physicians go to these meetings and look at ideal care. How do you visualize ideal care? And there was one meeting where the ideal care was visualized as a race car pit stop. The car stops, everybody descends, they do their part, car drives off. That's the thought. You can't do that with somebody who's medically fragile. You actually have to have somebody who's making judgment calls. This is wise, this isn't wise, and somebody you trust. So I guess my best suggestion would be talk to the doctor, the most senior doctor who's going to be making decisions, and get to know them in your healthcare system. And then when you go into the hospital, say, I'm Dr. Smith's patient. I'm his special patient, you know, so that you have some connection with somebody who's going to make an ethical decision. I don't have any more wisdom than that. Sorry.
Thank you. I think we're out of time. They're waiting to open the doors.
Yep. Thank you.